10:05, welcome back to the Chad Hasty Show, News Talk 790 KFYO, online at KFYO.com. You can send in your thoughts via email, chad at KFYO.com, or on social media, Facebook and on Twitter as well. Just about anywhere on social media you can find the show. That's where the show continues all day long. First voice you hear from when you dial in, very talented Ariel Walden on the other side, 770-5790. Toll free 1-800-687-0790. Jody also over there. We're making his job hard, telling people, I'm sorry, we're busy right now. You'll have to call back later. 770-5790. Toll free 1-800-687-0790. Joining me in studio, we have a great hour coming up here, folks. From the Texas Public Policy Foundation, the executive director also Center for Healthcare Policy, joining me in studio, Arlene Wilgemuth. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us today.
Absolutely. And also, we've heard from Chuck DeVore before, the vice president of policy. You see his writings quite a bit on the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Also Breitbart, Texas as well, Breitbart, California. Chuck DeVore, welcome.
Great to be with you in studio.
Yeah, I appreciate y'all coming in. Let's kind of get first to talking about healthcare, because we just had a big healthcare ruling come down about Obamacare and subsidies. How is this going to impact? We've already had some, I know, through the AP say, well, this could have an impact here. But realistically, where does this have an impact, and what does this say about Obamacare overall?
It's going to have a tremendous impact. And, of course, we've been watching this Halbig case for quite a while and been very hopeful of its outcome. So we're very pleased with the results today. What it demonstrates is how poorly written this legislation was, and it's as ill-conceived as it is poorly written. If you took every bad idea for what to do about health care and rolled it into one bill, that's pretty much the description of the Affordable Care Act. And it really shows a difference between our philosophy of free market, individual liberties, individual freedom, individual responsibility, and those who believe in a centralized, top-down style of government. This is top-down at its extreme, mm-hmm. and it's not working. It's causing health insurance premiums to rise dramatically, becoming even less affordable for the people of this country. And the sad part about it, Chad, is that there are so many things that could be done to lower the cost of health insurance for everyone and make it back into insurance instead of a prepaid health care plan.
Well, I think this also shows the problem that you have not only with a piece of legislation like Obamacare, which is truly complicated and very complicated, but also just overall with any piece of legislation that is passed with people not reading it, not knowing what they're getting themselves into, and not knowing what they're voting on. This is a perfect example of what happens.
Indeed it is. And, of course, we've often heard quoted, we have to pass the bill before we can read it. That shows that there was a lack of debate on the bill, and the debate would have worked out some of these problems or perhaps killed the legislation, which is exactly what was about to happen. It's why they had to pass it in such a rush. Our hope is that there will be real reform. There are things that need to be changed in the healthcare system, even before March of 2010 when this legislation was passed. We need reform of the healthcare system, but this is not the answer. It's just doubling down on what was not working.
What do you think the answer is when it comes to healthcare? Because you hear it all the time from the left. Republicans just want to repeal it. Republicans, conservatives just want to get rid of healthcare. They want to go back to the old days. You don't hear a lot from at least conservative Republican lawmakers as of yet to replace what we have or even replace Obamacare. So what is the answer, you think?
Well, there are many good ideas out there that have been floated. They're just not being talked about by the press because they support the ACA. So, but some of the things that need to happen first are, first of all, leveling the tax deduction. Right now, tax deductions are available for those who are employed through their employer, but they're not available for purchasing your health insurance if you're an individual. So whether you go everyone have or everyone not have a tax deduction, it needs to be the same because individual ownership would be a great benefit. Another thing that has been proven to work splendidly in the past are health savings accounts. Mm. They have been proven to lower the cost of health insurance by 12 to 20% in the first year, and then keep health insurance cost rising no more than the regular inflation of the economy instead of the health care inflation. So health savings accounts work. They should be given priority in our system. And they were increasingly used and still are increasingly used in the business world because they do work to help control cost. The reason that they work and the reason that the ACA doesn't work is our system has devolved into one where the patient has no financial interest in saving money, and neither does the healthcare provider. Instead of having a financial relationship with your doctor, you have a financial relationship with your employer, who has a financial relationship with the insurance company, who has a financial relationship with the doctor. And so neither the purchaser nor the provider have an interest in holding down cost. And that's what health savings accounts do, is they restore that relationship.
We're talking about Obamacare because right now we just had a big ruling that came down. I'm sure the administration will not give up. They'll continue. They'll try to appeal this and see where it goes forward. Where do you think this ends? Because you have a lot of folks who are out there who, many listeners out there right now, who they want this thing repealed. They want Obamacare over with. You do have some lawmakers who say repealing it piece by piece probably won't happen. The best way is to go through the courts. Is that the best way? Is that how it eventually will be gone if that does happen?
That's where it is right now. Hopefully things will change in the future, but right now it's with the courts. And the courts already dealt a significant blow in the NFIB versus Sebelia case that we all hoped would overturn Obamacare in total. But it didn't. But it did give the states the opportunity or the option of choosing whether or not to expand their Medicaid program, which is a state-federal program for those who can't afford it, certain populations who can't afford it. At this time, 24 of the 50 states have chosen not to expand Medicaid, which is a wise decision. Mm-hmm. It's very expensive. It does not deliver good health outcomes. There are that portion of our health care system needs desperately to be reformed. So that was one blow. Another blow that we feel is all the delays that have happened. But mm-hmm. but this Halbig case, if the ruling stands with the Supreme Court, it will be a very significant blow because it means that those states that have not established their own exchange, their citizens will not be eligible for federal subsidy. So you're going to again have winners and losers among the states. And it's certainly our hope that the entire law fails because it truly is an ill-conceived law that does not work for the benefit of the people of this nation.
Do you anticipate, and we're about to have to go to break here, but do you anticipate that there will be even more delays? Because let's be honest, I think most of these delays were politically based from the administration to get some votes, to get support out there. Heading into the midterm election, well, one election after the other, nationally. Do you think mm-hmm. there'll be more delays?
It's quite possible. We have, we'll see what the insurance rates are that will come out in November and December of this year. We'll see how many more policies are canceled. We'll see how many more people are denied, insurance that is not deemed to be satisfactory mm-hmm. from the federal level. The system is falling apart because it was very poorly designed, very poorly written legislation, and we need to hit the reset button.
When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about the conservative budget, maybe a story you heard about a week or two ago. We'll talk about that and your phone calls as well. Texas Public Policy Foundation, we visit with them throughout the legislative session. Well, the legislative session is coming upon us. It's you hear about it all the time, and just because they're not meeting right now doesn't mean that people aren't working behind the scenes, and we'll talk about that and much more when we come back here on the Chad Hastie Show. right, back on the Chad Hasty Show, News Talk 790 KFYO. Thank you very much for tuning in. In studio with me from the Texas Public Policy Foundation, Arlene Wilgemuth and Chuck DeVore. And let's talk a little bit about the budget. That is something that everybody always wants to talk about when it comes to the upcoming session. And just recently, was it last week, the conservative budget, that was a big news story.
Yes, it was. We've been spending the last few months during the summer really analyzing the historical Texas budget going back about a dozen years and trying to account for some of the accounting, shall we say, creative accounting efforts that the legislature has done to try to mask the total spending. For example, in the last legislative session, they took about $6 billion of patient income. This was income to state-run or state-affiliated hospitals, for example, with the University of Texas. And they took this income from patients and they shifted it off books, so it no longer counted toward the overall budget, and thus the budget kind of appears to be $6 billion smaller than it ought to be. And so we went back and we looked for efforts like that, analogous efforts going back a dozen years, to kind of true up the budget and come up with our own baseline as to how much spending was done. And then our next step was to develop the conservative Texas budget, which was to say, you know, what would spending in the state of Texas look like if we restrained spending through every biennium to the sum of population and inflation for the previous biennium? And if you did that, if you had done that for the past 10 years, the average Texas family of four would see taxes at about $1,200 a year less than they're paying today. And that, again, is allowing for government to grow at the rate of the population increase in Texas, which is pretty substantial, as well as inflation. So what we propose is that the legislature should strengthen the tax and expenditure limitation. Right now, the way they do it is they look at the a forecast of personal income for the coming 2 years, mm-hmm. and then they decide which one of those forecasts they want to use. So it's a bit of a political decision. And the problem with that, Chad, is there's no truing up. In other words, if the forecast wasn't hit, then there's nothing in the law that says that you have to spend less.
Right.
It's simply a political decision. What we'd like to do is instead have the limitation be the population and inflation growth from the prior 2 years, and then there's no debate about it. It is what it is, and that's what the limit will be going forward. And if the legislature applied that in the upcoming biennial session, spending would increase 6.2%, which ought to be sufficient to fund the basic needs of government in the state of Texas.
Now, what are you hearing from Republicans? What are you hearing from conservatives on this? Obviously, you're going to have some that say, well, I don't know, we may need to spend more than that. It seems like beforehand it's a guessing game mixed with politics, all rolled into one.
Well, that's a very insightful question because there's a number of things going on right now. First of all, as you know, there's a vote this November to take some money from the state's savings account, the Economic Stabilization Fund, which is primarily filled, of course, with oil and gas taxes. And that's getting to the point where it's just bursting at the seams. Well, if you take that money, that's about a little over $1.4 billion for roads. Now, they want to make sure that that doesn't go on this current spending limit. So that'll be spent off budget. Even so, though, you still have calls that, oh, we need to spend even more money on roads and we need to spend even more money on water. We say, fine, if you want to spend more money, you can spend more money. Just prioritize that within other competing spending priorities within the budget. So you are hearing quite a bit of push to spend all the money, to spend that surplus. Now, here's the challenge. They spent so much money in the current biennium that we're in now that we're getting very close to the current tax and expenditure limitation that would trigger a special vote in the upcoming legislative session to bust the state spending cap. And that's the cap that's more loose, right? The one that we'd like to see tightened. Mm-hmm. And that would have some very interesting political ramifications if among the first orders of business, the legislature had to vote to break the spending limit for the current biennium we're in now, because what's happening is Medicaid costs and expenditures are growing more rapidly than anticipated. And even though it looks like we may have a surplus somewhere in the neighborhood of $10 billion, just because you have the money doesn't mean that you can legally spend it under the current spending limit. You have to take a special vote. Yes, there's some interesting cross currents with fiscally prudent lawmakers thinking that this idea would be a good idea, and others that would like to see more money spent on things like education or healthcare or roads, saying that we oughtn't to limit spending, that this is a bad idea to try to limit spending in the upcoming biennium to 6.2%.
And the importance of what Chuck is saying for the individual taxpayer out there is, when there's money, if it's all spent, you grow government. Mm-hmm. Then the next time that there is an economic downturn, you have this enormous size of government that you have to support. So how is it normally supported? Through a tax increase.
Right, exactly. Now, with all of this, and I think we have about 1 or 2 minutes here before the hard time break, education. Obviously, there's still some ongoing questions about how much to spend on education. How much will the state be forced to spend on education? How does that get wrapped up in this?
Well, obviously, for advocates of public education, there's no such thing as enough. What we would like to see is significant reforms in Texas public education, where parents and children have sound, good, high-quality choices as to how to educate, how to begin their life's path as they head toward a career. And right now, we have this one-size-fits-all solution that is more or less borrowed from the Industrial Revolution. And here we now have things like eBay and Amazon and YouTube, and yet none of these technologies have really made their way into the way we educate children. So we would like to see more blended learning, more online learning, more options for children, especially children who are in families that don't make a lot of money. You know, it's not right that the only people that have choice for high quality education are those that live in a high cost zip code. Mm-hmm. And so we would like to see that discussion held before we start talking about merely how much money we're putting into the system.
When you talk about how the state is spending a lot of money, may bust through that cap. When we come back, I want to talk about Governor Perry obviously had a recent announcement about National Guard. State's going to have to pay for that. Where does emergency funding come in? And also something that that we were talking about during the break, the Star Fund as well, which is a major part of the Liberty Action Agenda as well with the Texas Public Policy Foundation. We'll talk about that and much more when we come back here on the Chad Hastie Show. Chad Hastie Show, News Talk 790 KFYO, Texas Public Policy Foundation. Chuck DeVore, Arlene Wilgermuth in studio, and appreciate both of y'all coming in today and staying an extended period of time to talk about what all is going on with the Texas Public Policy Foundation, what y'all are focusing on going forward into the next legislative session. Let's talk about the Star Fund and how this ties into the conservative budget and into the budget process.
That's a great question. The STAR Fund stands for the Sales Tax Reduction Fund. And the concept behind the Sales Tax Reduction Fund, or STAR Fund, is pretty simple. We want to make it easier for lawmakers to both cut the budget and cut taxes and send the results of their fiscal prudence back to taxpayers so that taxpayers can get the benefit of restraining government spending. Now, currently, the way the budget process works in Texas, once the budget, basically the baseline, is agreed to, it's very, very difficult for members to actually cut overall spending. They can cut maybe from one department and shift the money to another priority. But cutting that overall budget, once that baseline is created, is very, very difficult. And so what we'd like to see is the creation of a fund into which you can deposit money. For example, what if you found a department that was created 35 years ago and maybe the purpose for its creation is kind of faded away and yet it's still going on? Because as Ronald Reagan said, there's nothing closer to eternity on earth than a federal program. So we have that, of course, here in Texas. And so if you can eliminate or reduce a program, you can take that savings and put it into the STAR Fund account. And then that would allow the comptroller to reduce the state portion of the sales tax for a certain period of time. And then it would automatically go back up when those funds were used up, because as you reduce the sales tax, the money in the fund would end up going back to the state coffers to make up for that reduction in the sales tax. And so we'd like to see the STAR Fund passed in this coming legislative session. If it is, it'd be too early to be used. It couldn't be used in the upcoming session, but it could be used in subsequent sessions after that. So that's a tool to help lawmakers reduce and restrain the state budget and send that surplus back to taxpayers so that they get the benefit of our holding down government spending.
I think it's a great idea. However, I'm sure you've heard from lawmakers already who have talked about this, saying, yeah, but we can use the money over here. We can use that money over here, right? That's an argument. That's an ideology you have to fight.
Well, it is. But as we said before the last break, we are right up against the state spending limit. And of course, what you're seeing then is lawmakers resorting to kind of this ledger domain where they shift the spending off books so it doesn't have to count against that spending limit. Well, that shows you that we're already spending up against the stops. And as Arlene said earlier before the break, when you do that, when you constantly spend as much money as the state of Texas and their taxpayers are able to send to government, you are running the high risk, the grave danger that when the economy slows down just a little bit, then all of a sudden you've run out of money because you've grown government so that you're spending all the money when times are good. And we don't want to do that. We don't want to put ourselves into a position where we're basically forced against the wall and are faced with choices of big spending cuts and or huge tax increases.
Have you heard from any lawmakers who say, okay, we like the idea of cutting, we like the idea of getting rid of departments we don't need, but we have this rainy day fund over here where we want to put some more money? Because it seems like, and I've heard arguments before that, why don't we get rid of the rainy day fund? Kick that money back to the taxpayers, kick that money back to the citizens. We don't need to have as much built up. I'm sure there would be some lawmakers out there who would say, well, if we do cut a department, we should add the money here instead of giving it back.
Well, the challenge with the rainy day fund right now is, of course, you've got that vote this November that will take quite a bit of money and divert it away from that rainy day fund, and that will slow the growth a little bit. Now, eventually, it'll reach its statutory maximum, and when that happens, the extra money spills into general revenue and ends up adding to pressure to increase that budget. Now, with a STAR fund, you could take that spillover, put it into the STAR fund, and then refund it to the people.
Sounds like a good idea. Now, let me ask you this, and Chuck, I know there are a lot of times where you write just a ton of stories on comparing California, Texas, other states to the state of Texas. How can we apply some of the models that we have here in the state to maybe other states or even to the federal government?
That's a wonderful question, because I really do think that if you were to look at the 50 states, not only do you have laboratories of democracy where it was intended by the founders in a federal system that the states would compete against each other and that there'd be good ideas and bad ideas that would come out of the states and everyone else could look and say, well, gee, what's working in Kansas? What's working in Louisiana? And let's maybe try it here. Well, you really have two states that kind of epitomize this worldview about government, this dramatic choice between more taxes and more government and more freedom, more liberty, more money in your pocket. And the two biggest states where 20% of Americans live really are the epitome of that, California and Texas. And the nice thing about the two biggest states is that demographically they're very, very similar.
Yes.
California and Texas have the same exact percent of Hispanics to the decimal point. And if you look at other racial and ethnic groups, again, the two biggest states are very, very similar. And yet they have very divergent outcomes. And so I really think that as we have this national discussion about what type of government is best for the American people, we ought to start with the two biggest states and how different they are. And then very quickly, if you look at taxation at the state and local level as a percent of the economy, California taxes about 42% more than does Texas as a share of its wealth. Now, you would think that with all that taxation, that people who are living in poverty would be better off in California than in Texas. But in point of fact, there's been this new U.S. Census Bureau survey called the Supplemental Measure of Poverty. It takes into account cost of living. Remember, the cost of living in California is almost 40% higher than it is in Texas. So it takes into account cost of living, the value of government benefits and taxes. And if you look at all of those things, California has the nation's highest poverty rate, with about 45% more people proportionately living in poverty. So for every three people in poverty in California, there's about two in Texas. And yet they have all these programs for the poor.
Right.
How can this be so? Why is it that California has the nation's highest poverty rate with this, again, new, more comprehensive Census Bureau measure of poverty?
I'm glad you brought up the demographics in the two largest states, because they are very similar. You look at, and both states are talked about, rising Hispanic demographic. You just look across the board. Two states are very similar, except when it comes to the politics. How quickly can Texas go down the road of California? If bad decisions are made, how quickly could that happen?
It's another very good question. First of all, let's talk about the differences, not only culturally and regionally, but there's another big difference in that California is not a right-to-work state, and Texas is. Mm-hmm. And because of right-to-work, it makes it very difficult for those who advocate for more government and higher taxes to mobilize armies, as you see in California, these political armies that go out and knock door to door. You just don't have that equivalent firepower here in Texas. The other thing is that because of the lower burden in taxation, the lighter regulatory burden, the better lawsuit climate, it's a lot easier to start a small business and work for yourself here in Texas than it is in California. And as a result, you see a lot more entrepreneurship among minorities where they're participating in the American dream than you see in California. And I think that is critical. It is absolutely critical. And the missing ingredient that I really think that we need to fix in Texas to prevent any possibility of going down the California path is education reform. We absolutely owe it to our children to reform education in Texas so that poor children have every opportunity to succeed and to make it in the great state of Texas.
And on a slightly different topic, Chad, we began a new center last summer, the Center for Local Governance, that expresses our concern over one area that Texas is not doing well. You ask how quickly we could go down the tubes. We have a very low rate of debt for our state, but we are second in the nation for local debt.
Yes.
And the concern there is what our cities are doing. And so we began our Center for Local Governance to try to give some alternatives, and we're beginning to have a good deal of success across the state.
Yeah, and well, Texas Public Policy Foundation, obviously many different departments there. Y'all do a lot of work. TexasPolicy.com, the website where people can get more information. Arlene Wogemuth and Chuck DeVore, thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.